Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we were joined by our very, very good friend, Levan Skera. Now, regular listeners of No Such Thing as a Fish will be well aware of Levan. He has been on our show many, many times. He is always absolutely brilliant, and we always love it when he comes over from Belgium and tells us all his amazing facts about science. Now, if you would like to learn more about a particular kind of science, AI, then do I have good news for you, because Levan is coming over in March to do a live tour across the UK, north, south, east, west. He's coming along and he will be telling you all about AI. Would you believe it's more complicated than just getting a program on your computer and asking it questions and it getting the questions wrong? There is more to it, and we're better to learn about it than with Levan Skera, the man sometimes called the Stephen Fry of Belgium. I know that quite a lot of companies are snapping up tickets because they want their employees to learn all about AI, and Levan is such a good science communicator. Definitely, it is a place to go if you want to learn about that subject and have a laugh along the way. If you want to know more about that, then go to levanskera.com. Probably you can't spell that if you're British, so he has also bought the domain Leaving Shire, like what a hobbit might do, perhaps, leavingshire.com. If you type that into your address bar, you will get his website and you'll be able to get tickets. If you want to learn more about No Such Thing as a Fish, then a good place to go at the moment is patreon.com/nosuchthingasafish, where you can join any one of our three tiers, the lowest of which, £4 a month, will get you dual, drop us a line. Where have you ever listened to the show and thought, those guys have got something wrong? Well, if you have, then other people have thought that as well, and they have sent us emails, and Andy goes through them and picks out the very best, and he quizzes us about them. It's not just things we got wrong, it's also people with extra material, because there are so many experts listening to our show, so it's a really good place, if you've enjoyed the previous episodes, to learn a little bit more about those subjects. Patreon's also got a free tier. There's a little bit on there, I think, if you sign up to No Such Thing as a Fish on the free tier. But it's also a place where we will announce new things as and when they happen. And I can tell you, a lot is cooking up at No Such Thing as a Fish HQ. So if you want to learn more, go to patreon.com/nosuchthingasafish. Anyway, really hope you enjoy this week's show with Levan Skera. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, James Harkin, and Levan Skera. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that when the father of supercomputing, Seymour Cray, got stuck on a problem, he would go into tunnels he built under his house and speak to elves.
My kind of guy.
So this is a guy called Seymour Cray. He built some of the first supercomputers, and according to one of his colleagues, who's John Rollwagon, Cray said that when he got stuck on a problem, he'd go under there and the elves come with the solutions to his problems.
Yeah.
What is certainly true is that he was brilliant at sort of getting a computer problem, going away, just thinking about it, and then getting the answer.
Yeah, so it's an interesting story because it's sort of, he had such weird myths about him. Did he really talk to elves? Was he messing with his friend? There was a story that he built his own boat. And at the end of every year, he would burn the boat. And then he would build a new boat the next year because he loved building things and he loved creating a new thing on the blank page.
Oh, cool. I heard that he burned a boat just because he'd built a new one.
And he didn't want to pay the tax on two boats?
Unclear. Unclear.
Well, a lot of people think that he did do that once and then it became the myth that he did it once a year. But he did like his thinking time.
Yeah. Have you come across this guy, Levan?
No, I haven't. Some supercomputers have a great history. You know that the US Air Force once built a supercomputer out of PlayStation 3s.
No.
The Condor console.
Really?
Yes. Wow. They bought $2 million of PlayStation 3s.
Wow.
And they took out the computer chip.
What were they trying to play?
analyzing satellite images.
Cool.
And the thing,
I've not played that game. It sounds good.
It sounds right up your street, yeah, in fairness, Andy.
Well, once Flight Simulator's been knocked on the head.
You need 1,760 PS3s to build a supercomputer.
Right.
And the reason they did it was that it saved them $8 million.
But they weren't using the PlayStation itself. They were extracting a chip from it, did you say?
I think they used most of the hardware. And
okay, right.
You could run Linux on it back in the day. Mm. So you're in the Russian military and your secrets are cracked by 1,700 PS3s.
But so what is a supercomputer then? Because that's a collection of PlayStations. Yeah. Does that count as a supercomputer?
I think there's no like official definition of them.
But it's a term that I think was coined to make the difference with the mainstream computing power of that time, and that changes constantly. Now, the PS3 supercomputer was in the top 50 of computing power at that time, 2010. So it did qualify as a supercomputer.
And this guy, Seymour Cray, his computers were super because he basically was one of the first people to use transistors. So a transistor is like an electrical switch. You know, a computer goes with zeros and ones. Your transistor will tell you if it's a zero or a one because it switches one way or the other. Before that, they used vacuum tubes, so like light bulbs almost. And whether the light bulb was on or whether it was off, that would be your zero or one. And that's how they'd work out all the logical things they had to work out.
Right.
So he could suddenly make things much, much smaller.
The fastest supercomputer right now,
yeah.
What can it do in the space of a second?
So the fastest supercomputer, I think, at the moment is called El Capitan at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And let's say, Dan, you were to do a coin flip against everyone in Japan.
Yeah.
Okay.
As you do.
As I've been trying to do for many decades.
You'll get a yes from a commissioner one day. It's a really fun idea.
And then once you've done, then Levan does the same against everyone in Japan.
Yeah.
And then Andy does, then I do. And then everyone in the world does a coin flip against every single person in Japan. This El Capitan would be able to manage all those results in a single second.
Which is not a long TV show. I can see why AI is ruining the arts.
Japan against the world. It's petaflop time.
But I like this word petaflop. So flop is a floating point operation, so an addition or a multiplication. And then peta comes after tera, I think. Mega, yeah. Giga.
X is after peta.
X is even bigger.
Yeah.
So we've got a new supercomputer in the UK. It opened up last summer. It's in Bristol. It's called Isambard AI. And it's going to be used, the Guardian reported various things it's going to be used for. Improving skin cancer detection rates.
Great.
Really good. Predicting crowd movements and maybe if there's going to be an accident on a construction site. You know, it can sort of...
Like a brick starts falling, it can work out where it's going to land?
Exactly. I mean, or maybe even more useful than that. And also how to spot sick dairy cows in Somerset.
That's good.
And there are a lot of dairy cows in Somerset. And if they're getting early signs of mastitis, that's a real pain for them.
You know what? I went onto Google News last week.
Yeah.
And I searched for supercomputer. And these headlines were all on the first page. Supercomputer tips Morocco to win 2025 African Cup of Nations trophy. Supercomputer reveals who's had the easiest ties in the FA Cup. Supercomputer predicts Man United finish as Michael Carrick takes over. Supercomputer delivers Leeds United versus Fulham prediction. And supercomputer predicts where FA Cup journey will end for Mansfield Town.
I can see who's funding the research for this.
I'm so glad we're using City's worth of water and electricity to come up with this vital stuff about Mansfield Town or Leeds United. What is going on?
Isn't that so weird? But what I think is happening is a normal computer is doing these calculations right. in a journalist's office somewhere, and they're just thinking, let's call it a supercomputer. I assume mad. That's what's happening, right?
Yeah, it's not a protected term, is it?
I don't think so.
I don't think it is.
Super in front of everything.
I feel like Seymour Cray's was the first properly called a supercomputer,
right.
I think. I just one last fact on him. So, Dan, you said he had this intense focus. Mm. He would spend days in complete seclusion, maybe in the tunnels under his house. There are stories also that he was very afraid about nuclear war. So he was digging sort of bomb shelter or having bomb shelters dug under his home. I don't know how true that is. But apparently he would often, on family car journeys, demand complete silence so he could think for the entire duration of the journey.
Oh, that's my man.
I mean, the dream. The absolute dream.
So, but wait a minute. Surely the kids are watching Frozen in the back. Are they watching that on mute?
They're not allowed to watch anything.
What?
The whole family have to stay silent because Dad is driving and thinking.
They're watching a great man think.
But what more entertainment can you have? Oh, Let It Go is nothing compared to watching Seymour Cray have
Seymour
an idea.
Cray, I can pay to watch Seymour Cray think from the back of a car.
I don't care how the wheels on the fucking bus are going. I need to work out how many pizza flops are in this computer.
Or you will not have the iPad by 2010 to watch your shows on.
Yes, exactly.
And then when everybody else is silent, you still have the elves babbling in your ear, of course. Shut up, elf.
Can I tell you a mad thing about where supercomputers are going to go next?
Oh, yes, please.
You have a guess?
League 2 That's football right. results.
Where it's going to go next?
Yeah.
Space.
Oh. Quantum computing? Oh, computers in space.
Going to go up there.
Oh, is
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
For the cooling. It's cold. And,
yeah. China are trying to get lots of people are trying to get a supercomputer in space. Everyone wants it to be in orbit. You know, Bezos and all sorts of people. And basically the theory is, on the ground, all the computing power uses lots of energy and lots of water for the cooling and things like this. Up there, it's solar power. Well, we have solar power down here, but solar up there and cooling requirements are not nearly as big.
Well, solar power is 24 hours if you choose the right orbit, so you don't have nights. Cooling is a strange thing because it is very cold, but also there is very little material, so you're kind of in a vacuum.
It's like, it's like you can't sweat.
Yeah, so the ISS has this big gray things that some people think they are solar panels, but they're actually the only way to cool the ISS is by radiation, like radiate the power off. Oh. And these things are to radiate the power away. So you need some sort of cooling in space too.
Okay,
But it's a different way than liquid cooling that we do here.
Could we cook something with radiation in space and then that comes back to Earth?
I guess so, yeah.
I've just had an idea, that's all. I'm just going to write to Bezos after this.
Bye, Andrew, space sausage!
I'm thinking space sausage.
How are you? What, when SpaceX is straight there?
SpaceX! Oh my God.
I don't want to deal with Musk. Space sausage. You send the satellite up surrounded by a thick layer of meat, right?
Yeah.
It's like a Scotch egg. a giant Scotch egg in space. And as it cooks, it drops off and comes back to Earth. When it's cooked.
How does it not burn on re-entry?
Oh, we'll solve this down the line. I'm asking for $100 million, all right?
Just fair dues. Just quickly on Seymour Cray.
Oh, yeah.
He was born and eventually set up his offices in a place called Chippewa Falls in Wisconsin.
Oh yeah.
I try to see if it had any other impact on the world, Chippewa Falls as well. Yeah. So two I could find, a lady called Judith Ann Hensk, who was a singer in America, was the original singer of a song that's had a bit of an influence on the world because the song was called High Flying Bird.
Oh, and Noel Gallagher's band is named after it.
Noel Gallagher's band is named after that.
Is
so,
it really?
Yeah, so
huge.
Yeah, huge influence on the world there.
That's one.
The second one is...
Can it be better? I don't think... I'd stop that. I don't think you're going to cap.
Get ready.
Come on.
It is the hometown of Jack Dawson, who sadly died on the Titanic in the movie Titanic.
What?
Leonardo DiCaprio's character is called Jack Dawson.
Okay, okay.
So there's a scene in the movie where Kate Winslet is standing on the front and she's about to jump off and he talks her out of it. And he talks about the time when he was standing on a frozen lake in Chippewa Falls, his hometown, and how it cracked and how cold it was when he went under and so on. And so that's the other main thing that they're known for, except the lake wasn't there until after the sinking of the Titanic. So it's a goof.
There's a new lake?
Yeah, that's sort of a man-made lake in Chippewa Falls, and it wasn't made until 1917.
Gosh.
Now, James Cameron did a whole thing where he changed the literal sky to put the stars in the right place when he redid the Titanic movie because he got that wrong.
Neil deGrasse Tyson complained about it.
Yeah.
Neil deGrasse Tyson was watching the movie and at one point said, the sky is wrong.
I think Neil deGrasse Tyson needs to get his priorities right with the complaining.
Well, so Cameron changed it. He redid it for the anniversary release.
And he hasn't changed
this? He's going to have to go back now and do it all over again.
Wow.
Do you think you have the same authority as Neil deGrasse Tyson when it comes to James Cameron's ear?
Hundy P. Hundy P.
Of course.
Yeah. He'll probably just hand back all the money. He'll probably say, you know what, I'm going to stop making Avatar 9 and I'm just going to focus full time on time traveling this lake back in time. That'll be his solution.
Avatar, by the way, which is 100% scientifically accurate all the way through, right?
Yeah, exactly. I haven't seen what the modern computers look like, the supercomputers, but aesthetically, they're really beautiful, the original Cray supercomputers. So Seymour Cray's Cray 1 was a sort of tall cylinder in the middle.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And then it had sort of like leather seating around the bottom that you could genuinely sit on. And it was because the cooling system that it needed was underneath. And it just was a thing that was part of the design.
Was it heated seats then?
Yeah.
Superheated seats though.
Yeah, it keeps getting referenced as love seats. And there's a few suggestions that people would sleep on it, not for...
It was the 60s.
Yeah, but there's
is that a big cylindrical supercomputer in your pants? Or?
I'm afraid it's an exaflop.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, we are sponsored this week by Squarespace.
Yeah, you guys know Squarespace. It is the all-in-one website platform that is designed to help you, your business, your personal projects stand out on the big worldwide web so that people come and think, ooh, this person knows what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so convenient, simple. I'll just give you an example of a couple of the services they offer. So if you want to have fantastic SEO tools, help your website get discovered fast, Squarespace has integrated tools which are designed to show you up as much as possible on search engines and bring in more of the customers you want. Or if you want to fundraise on your website, there are built-in donation tools. If you want to showcase videos, you can do that and create stunning video libraries. There's so much you can do.
That's right. So head to squarespace.com/fish. You'll get a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use that offer code FISH and you will save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
That's right. squarespace.com/fish. Do it now.
On with the show.
On with the podcast.
Okay, it's time for fact number two, and that is Lieben.
My fact is that a crane is called a crane because it looks like a crane. Any questions?
Yes. Which crane is which?
Aha. The crane, the machine,
is
named after the crane, the bird.
And what does this have to do with Seymour Cray?
Nothing yet. I'll ask the elves.
Yeah.
Medieval cranes looked like the birds. Have you seen a medieval crane on paintings?
Only through the process of researching this,
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't, though, before, no.
Yeah, so a medieval crane would be a wooden building, in a way. And it had these two, what do you call them, where the hamster would run around him?
Treadmill.
Yeah, treadmills. So it had two big treadmills at the side, and people would walk in the treadmills to make the rope move. And then from these two large treadmills, there was kind of a wooden building diagonally going up like 10, 15 meters. And then from the top, there would be a small piece going diagonally down again. where the rope would come out. And they would use this in harbors to take loads out of it. And these old medieval cranes, they look a lot like a crane, the bird standing in a field. And so that's why they were called cranes.
So very cool. They're very beautiful. I had not seen one of these before, these tread wheel cranes.
Yeah.
And they're mad. I think there's a place where they're trying to build a castle authentically in France, and they're using one or two of these actual things.
Oh, wow.
And Tom Scott, who's been on this show, has made a video where he goes and like operates this crane.
Really?
It's crazy.
And they were used for like quite famous things like Cologne Cathedral.
So much.
Salisbury Cathedral.
And it turns out that if you have enough people and enough time as well, because it moves slowly, but you can basically lift many, many, many tons in weight just by someone walking around.
If you have the right gears.
Yeah.
If you have the right gears, then you can certainly
Could
do it.
Could you like ratchet it and then use it as a catapult or something?
A trebuchet.
I don't know if because then you need a lot of torque on there, and maybe the wood wouldn't.
Okay, because I was thinking for Andy's meat in space business.
Yes. That's how we get it back down. That's a good idea.
Or is that how you're lobbing it up?
How I was lobbing it up.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay.
You've got to get the sausage up there, mate.
That's true.
Is that a slang expression I'm not familiar with?
It's a very, very normal expression here in the UK.
But get your sausage up, mate.
There was a Roman one called a polyspaston, which could lift 3,000 kilos per person walking in this thing. I mean, the gearing is amazing. And then they were used in ancient Rome, and then they weren't used for many centuries, and then in medieval times they came back. But they were still being installed in London in the 1850s.
Okay.
Wow.
I think there's one down in Guildford, actually. It's not in operation today. I think it's a historical one. But
there are a few that can still be found in the cellars of cathedrals because they used to move up with the floors. So if you've built the first floor, you would disassemble the entire crane and build it again on the first floor. So you could work your way up there. And then when they were at the top and the church was finished, they would just store it in the cellar. Like, they wouldn't build it up again, but all the material would be there.
That's very cool. Yeah,
do you know what the world's biggest crane is right now?
Right now?
Probably.
No. The bird or the machine?
We're talking machine still, okay, I think.
Yeah, sure.
So, is this guessable?
Absolutely not.
Is it?
What would you call it? What would you call it?
Mammoth.
Mammoth, no.
Oh, I see.
Mastodont.
These are great names. It's called Big Carl. And it's named after Carl Sarens, who works. He's a director of Sarens Engineering, which is a Flemish family business.
Oh,
which
what's it called?
Sarens. S A R E N S.
Absolutely. I see Sarens cranes all the time at my street.
Big Carl.
They're a family business. They started moving trees with horses and carts,
as you do,
and now they're into the world's biggest cranes.
Right.
And I was reading a trade magazine with an interview with Carl. And they said, what's going on with the crane industry? And he said, the whole industry is picking up.
Brilliant.
Which I don't think he deliberately did as a joke.
Doesn't translate in Dutch, actually.
Doesn't
business. Through the roof.
It's good. It's so good.
In these medieval cranes, so you had these big treadmills, and they used people to walk in there, sometimes children. Actually, in Ghent, there's still a crane children street. Kraankinderstraat. So they weren't like really small kids, but they were like teenagers and that were used. And they used animals, dogs, for example. There's still pictures of dogs standing in these treadmills, kind of sealed off of the world with a small wooden wall left and right. And so in the morning, you would put your dog in a treadmill and it would just walk. And in the evening, you opened the door and it could come out again.
You've got to make sure to put the dog in the right way around. Otherwise, you get home at the end of the day, it's disassembled half a cathedral. Nightmare.
Not again, Fifi.
These ones that we used, you've heard of a capstan, maybe? That's the thing, you see them on board a ship for lifting various things. It's where you've got a pole vertically and there are four spars coming out of it on the ground and you have people pushing them around in a circle.
Oh, yeah.
And that lifts something upwards.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big thing. They were used a lot in the sort of 15th, 16th century, especially to raise obelisks because Rome basically got a lot of obelisks from its territories in Egypt. So they were all in...
Stole.
Yeah. Why am I worried about medieval Romans coming at me? Yeah. They're all sort of nicked. But basically, to raise these, they would use capstans with hundreds of men and horses involved, pushing them around to lift them up. And I just love this detail. This comes, by the way, from Low Tech Magazine, which is an amazing... It's about the past and forgotten tech and how it can actually be very useful today. The website is solar-powered. It runs off author's home solar power system. Anyway, to raise this obelisk in the Vatican in 1586, it used 800 men, 140 horses, and, the best detail, spectators were ordered not to speak or make a noise on pain of death.
Oh, God.
Because hundreds of people were watching this very delicate operation.
It's like watching snooker.
It's like watching the snooker. And it was apparently enforced.
Seymour Cray was there. Will you shut up? All of you.
I want a Seymour Cray.
Oh, my God. So was the reason because, like, often you can't make noise because there's someone drumming to make sure everyone goes in the right
might well have been that. I don't know whether it was that or just like a mistake from distraction could have been fatal, you know. Wow. But yeah, sounds exciting. One last thing on crane cranes. In 2005...
Both of these things are crane cranes.
Which good point.
Which one are we talking about?
Mechanical cranes.
Mechanical cranes.
Oh, yeah.
This is just a crazy story. It happened in London, South London, 2005. 15-year-old girl was found on a crane at night, 130 feet above the ground. Riddle me this.
Well, sleepwalk is the obvious one.
She was asleep. She'd sleepwalked up there. And a passerby had seen someone up there, called the authorities. And then a fireman went up, crawled out, found her there asleep. Didn't know how to wake her up because thought, if I wake her up, she might, you know, she might panic. There's a chance.
Where was she asleep? I have a vague memory of this story that she was on the wait on the other side. Like, it's not even like she was in the cabin bit.
No. She was quite not that. Quite not.
Wow.
So it seems like he got her phone out of her pocket and called her parents from the phone and said, "Can you ring back? So that'll wake her up." And
I didn't know how did he get her login to her phone? Did he lift up her head and hold the camera in front of it?
It's 2006. It was a simpler time.
But you still had codes on phones, didn't you?
Maybe. Well, anyway, it was all fine in the end.
How do you navigate that opening sentence with the parents?
Yes.
Hi, I'm on a crane. A crane? Cranberries are named after cranes.
Really?
Craneberries, yeah. The organic crane.
Lovely.
Because the plant stamens look a bit like the beaks of cranes. Geraniums are named after cranes.
Wow.
From the Greek geranus, meaning crane.
Huh.
Because their seeds look like the crane bills.
The Dutch word for geraniums is stork beak. No, stork bill.
Ah, yeah. So they're quite similar birds. And pedigree, the word pedigree, also comes from the word for crane, the geranus. And that's because the foot of a crane has bits that stick out. And when you draw like a family tree, you have the bits that stick out.
Pedigeranos, foot of a crane.
Yeah.
That's so good.
That's really nice.
Oh, I love these etymology things that suddenly remove the blanket for
something.
Yes. Abracadabra.
Yes.
I love it.
That's great.
The crane is called a crane because of the noise. So they have they're migratory birds. Did I use the right amount of syllables? Yes, migratory birds. And so they fly over Belgium and Holland in huge groups, sometimes thousands of them. And they're quite high up. They have these long necks, and then you can hear. They make this crane. And so if you want to finish the etymology, the machine is named after the bird and the bird is named after the sound it makes. Mm. And in Belgium, we also say crane to a water tap, faucet.
Do you?
Because they also have, well, they used to have this vertical piece and then a horizontal piece, like a pump.
Cranes, Britain's tallest bird.
Oh, yeah.
What are we talking?
Oh, 9, 10, 12 feet. That big. That big.
Are they?
Well, if you put them on a hill. Yeah.
Great. No, they're 4 feet something.
Yeah, they're 4 feet.
1 meter 20, something like that, I think. Yeah, that is 4 feet, yeah.
Yeah. But they're making a comeback across the UK, which is very nice because they were hunted and eaten to extinction
classic.
In the UK. Also drying out wetlands. A lot of that went on in the Middle Ages, and that really damages their habitats.
People eat cranes. I've never heard of that, people eating cranes.
Apparently they are... I'm afraid to say they're absolutely delicious.
Are they?
Well, they certainly were in the 14th century when presumably food was a bit less nice. But no, in 1465, there was a new Archbishop of York and 204 cranes were roasted to celebrate the fact at the feast.
Right.
So they're, and then by 1600, miraculously, they were extinct. And but they're back, and it's partly because a random pair got blown off course, as you were saying, Levin. They're migratory. In 1979, they got blown off course. They ended up in the Norfolk Broads, and now there are maybe a couple of hundred and lots more breeding pairs, which is obviously the main thing. And there's a place in Suffolk where they are breeding, an RSPB site, Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And to help them breed, the staff have cut runways for them in the grasses, in the reeds, just to help them take off and land safely.
with the lights and everything, yeah. And the control tower.
And the guy with the ping pong bats.
We got five cranes coming in from 3-4 Facet, North Norfolk.
Look out, you're going to bump into a crane. What kind of crane? crane.
A small fact about the lighthearted topic of eating birds into extinction.
Oh, yeah.
This week...
I personally
ate the stork into extinction. I held with my hands the very last great auk that ever walked on this earth.
Really?
It was strangled in 1844 on Eldey, an island in Iceland. Right. And so great auks got really rare because, well, they can't fly, so people used to eat them. And back then, like 19th century, if an animal became really rare, it became super expensive because all the collectioners wanted one.
Yeah,
so,
it's amazing. I read an article about this where it's like it would become well known that there was an animal that they were about to go extinct.
Yeah.
And what people thought was not, shall we save them? They were like, this is our last chance to catch one.
Oh. And so these Icelandic sailors could make a nice buck out of strangling. You had to strangle them because otherwise you damaged the meat and the skin. So they know that the last great auk was killed on that island. The intestines were kept at Copenhagen, and for a long time they didn't know where the skin ended up. And then they did genetic testing on the intestines and on all the 67 great auks that are in museums, and it's in Brussels.
Wow.
So they found out this is the very last great auk that ever lived, and it's now up there. It's in a place called it's our National Institute for Natural Science. They have a huge collection of taxidermy. They have 1 million mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and then they have, I think, 30 million if you count all the insects with it. Wow. And they have this separate room for extinct species that is extra secured because they are very valuable. I met one of the conservators there, and almost weekly he makes the sad walk with a new species to the extinction.
Really?
This is, I want to film this one day, this weekly walk of getting the phone call, like, yeah, you know, that bird over there in that island, well, extinct now, put it in the special room, and then you have to take an animal to the extinction room. Yeah,
that's so sad.
It is.
You got anything funny to end the section?
No.
Okay, it is time for fact number 3, and that is Andy.
My fact is, a single gram of silica gel has an area of 800 square meters. Okay.
Strap in, everyone.
This is so much fun. Okay. You're about to go on the ride of your life, guys. There's a fantastic website called Scope of Work. It's really good. It's amazing essays about all sorts of stuff. You know the silica gel, the little packets do not eat, right?
Yeah.
They often come in 1 gram packets.
And they're to dry things out, right?
They're to dry things out.
They'll be in your shoes when you buy them.
Exactly. Like, or a bit of furniture or whatever. And that stuff in there is silica gel. And the reason it's amazing at drying things out is that when you zoom in on it, it's not like glass, which is silicon dioxide. It's much less dense than glass. Silica gel is full of these tiny, tiny, tiny pores. So they're 2.5 nanometers across, which is the width of one strand of DNA. Mm-hmm. But these little balls of silica gel are so riddled with these voids, these holes everywhere, that 1 gram of it has an internal area of 800 square meters. So that's 4 tennis courts. Like, they're absolutely amazing at taking on their own weight in water vapor because it all condenses in their tiny capillaries.
Right.
So that's why they're so effective. And when you're a shoemaker, for example, you're trying to say, they will say, silica gel sellers, how big do you want to keep dry? How big an area? How big a volume? And how dry do you want it to be? What's the maximum moisture you want inside the shoebox?
Yes.
And they can just gear it exactly because they know how much silica gel can absorb.
It is pretty amazing. I mean, we all know these packs. We've all got them in various items that we've bought. The say do not eat on it. Turns out that's not because, as everyone assumes, that they're toxic. They're not toxic.
They're delicious. They're like the cranes.
I remember when the Archbishop of Durham came in a few years ago, they had 200,000 silica gel packets, didn't they?
Yeah, so don't eat them, but it's largely for the packet, isn't it? It's to say don't eat. It's a choking hazard.
Okay. It's very funny. We have to say don't eat them because obviously we're not recommending people eat silica gel, but it doesn't seem like actual silica
gel. I don't think
gel.
It would be any good for you because it would absorb all the water. It would adsorb all the water because it doesn't absorb. Absorb is like a sponge. You get the water goes inside of it. Adsorb means that it sticks to the outside of it.
It's really weird.
But the outside is on the inside.
Precisely.
Of the silica gel.
It's like a weird net thing. I know. But anyway, so yeah, if you did eat a few of them and you had swallowing problems already, I don't think it would be that
good. Definitely.
But
don't
it's
eat
not
them.
Like
definitely
you're not gonna eat. People won't find an ancient Egyptian mummy if you accidentally swallow a tiny bit of it. It's not like it dries you into a husk. Which is an amazing assassination method.
Like the end of Indiana Jones.
That's how they achieve that effect set. Yeah.
Like all of these chalices have got a bit of silica gel in them apart from one.
but we should say the only potential reason you shouldn't eat them is that some of the beads might have a little moisture indicator, like which is to indicate when they change color, like cobalt chloride, which could be dangerous if you ate enough of it.
Don't eat them.
Take advice from the packet, not from us. But you'll be fine. But don't.
But one thing you could do, which I don't, I see that, I get scared, it's toxic, chuck it in the bin. Actually, collecting them is quite useful because they can be used. Not to eat.
Collectors.
Not to eat, no.
I'm sorry, but we've covered some pretty nerdy collectors. Surely. Surely there aren't collectors of this stuff.
It's not for the sake, it's not like a stamp collection. It is for if you drop your phone in the toilet or the bath, instead of putting it in rice, put it in a box full of these little packs and it's going to probably act better than the rice. So they have their uses. Apparently they're great for defogging windshields as well. If you just chuck your 100 silica packs you've saved.
I've heard musty smells of books.
Yeah.
It adsorbs all of the musty smell.
Yeah.
Rust in toolboxes. If you've got a slightly damp garage or something, just pop a bit of that in. Allegedly, if you have a big enough packet, you can deodorize your laundry.
But why don't we collect them and use them to lower the sea levels again?
Just
the thing with these numbers is that people have no idea of how small atoms are.
Yeah.
Atoms are, it's just crazy. We can't get our head around it. I used to have an example in my show on genetics. I talked about Julius Caesar, who bled to death. Let's say he lost 1 liter of blood. You take one glass of water like I have in front of me. What is the chance that I have a molecule in here, an H2O molecule, that literally exited a wound of Caesar as he bled to death? It's about 2,000 in each glass of water.
Wow.
But you definitely have that in there?
Yeah.
That belongs in a museum, man.
Yeah, well, the thing is that there are a lot more H2O molecules in a glass of water than there are glasses of water on Earth.
But so how much of history is sitting in that glass right now then?
Everything.
From the beginning of the planet, basically?
Dinosaurs? Dinosaur piss?
A lot of dinosaur piss. That's
Hitler
what I
piss.
Always...
Hitler piss.
That's what I always tell the homeopaths. Like, diluted dinosaur piss, right?
Yeah.
But maybe it turns out that actually dinosaur piss is the secret panacea medicine. And they've been right all this time.
Who knows?
Yeah.
I didn't know I'd been drinking Hitler piss this entire time.
There's some Dalai Lama piss in there too, and some Mahatma Gandhi piss, so it kind of evens out.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Here's something you can do with silica gel. You can make opals out of it.
Ooh.
So
the cars or the stones? Or?
The stones or the fruits?
Yeah.
No, the stones. Basically, opal is made of silica, but it's dehydrated and it's compressed by nature. But you can make opals in the lab by getting a load of silica gel, putting it in water, leaving it for weeks and weeks and months until it all sinks down and stacks itself perfectly. And then you remove all of the water and it's in a perfect lattice. And that's how you make lab-made opals.
Wow. That's very cool.
It's the same material, basically.
Yeah.
And in a different crystal structure.
Precisely, yeah.
When you start zooming in enough like this, everything gets a bit weird, I find. Like, this stuff, silica gel, was first created in the early 20th century by a researcher at Johns Hopkins University called Walter Patrick. And he created it out of a material called water glass, which, as far as I can tell, is water-soluble glass.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's not very useful in construction.
It's like quite hard to have a glass.
That just feels like sandy water, doesn't it?
I think if you pour if you have a glass of this stuff and you pour some water in, it dissolves, which is a good prank, if nothing else. But I find it so bizarre that this exists. And there's an amazing 1930 paper, The Story of Silica Gel, which I read too much of. And it's by the main silica gel making company, basically. And it begins, people really knew how to write science in the old days.
Oh, so it wasn't very dry.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Walked right into that. Stepped on that rake.
You set it up yourself.
I know. I left the rake out. The story of silica gel. Just listen to the way this begins, all right? Someday, the true history of mankind will be written. A history that will treat not the struggle of man against man, but of the epic struggle of man against the forces of nature. One great force of nature is oxidation, the intimate union of oxygen and carbon producing combustion. Combustion produces heat, and primitive man... This is about silica gel.
It's great. Wonderful.
It's so good.
It's Lord of the Rings style science.
It really is, though, isn't it? Yeah. One of us uses way more silica gel than the others. Can you guess?
Is it me because there's a K-pop band called Silica Gel?
That's not the reason, but it is you.
Well, I think I know why.
Go on.
I think just through my research.
Yeah.
I think it's James because of his cat.
Yes.
Okay. That's how I dry her. She's been out in the rain. She's
in there with the shoes now. Yeah. Don't eat it.
It's cat litter.
Adsorption, yeah.
That's the thing, we've been using. So World War One, after the invention by Walter Patrick, it was used in gas masks.
Yeah.
Yeah, salt shakers used to use it. In the cap, you would put little bits of it so that the salt wouldn't dry out.
Clump up.
Yeah, so it doesn't clump up because people would put bits of rice in there, right?
Yeah, rice.
But you would actually put little silica inside the top of salt caps.
I'm going to put some in my coffee tin when I get home.
Do not eat.
Oh, sorry.
How many times do we have to tell you?
But am I allowed to drink it?
You sounded like a health and safety Dalek there. Do not eat.
I'm just imagining you putting it in your coffee and you pour the water in your coffee and all the water's gone.
I put three kettles in here.
You can do that with the powder from diapers. It's a typical magic trick that you do in science shows. You take like three cups, like non-transparent cups, like paper cups, and in one of them you put the powder that is inside a diaper.
Oh, okay.
Like a baby diaper. You put it like 1 or 2 centimeters at the bottom, and then you pour water in all three of them. And if you take the one that had the powder, you can turn it around over your head and nothing will come out because I don't know if it absorbs or adsorbs, but it also sticks to the side. So
it turns a little bit white or something. Yeah. And I've seen people use it as fake snow, that stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, don't eat the yellow snow though.
Do not eat.
Is that toddler's pee?
That's brilliant.
I had one more thing about these one atom layers.
Oh yeah.
It's like graphene. So graphene is stuff that is made of one layer of atoms, carbon atoms, all in hexagonal shapes. It's the stuff that your pencil is made of. Mm. So you're writing with graphene. And the cheapest way that they made one layered graphene, it's very difficult to make something of one atom thick. The cheapest way was with sticky tape. You just put sticky tape on a pencil and you rip it off, and then you put sticky tape on the sticky tape and you rip it off again, and you keep going until there's just one layer left.
Wow.
Right. It's kind of a low-tech way to make graphene.
It's a silly question. How do you get it off the sticky tape?
I do not know. I think you study it on the sticky tape.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, so it's not for production.
No. And then you put electricity on it and stuff. Yeah, it was science.
Because we've met Andre Geim.
Yeah.
Who discovered it, I think. But he won a Nobel Prize for it, definitely. And he also won an Ig Nobel Prize for levitating frogs.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that's right. He was at his university and there was a giant magnet and he was walking past it one day. And I think on a whim, he chucked a ham sandwich in and just to see if it would float. And it did. So then he
This is how these people cut, like putting a sausage in space, putting a ham sandwich in a magnet. You know, these ideas, they seem stupid at the time.
We do the impossible. And then 30 years from now, we get the call from the Nobel Committee and it's like, yeah, thought that would happen eventually. Yeah.
It was the Ig Nobel Prize he won for that one. Yeah, not the Nobel Prize.
For the frogs, yeah.
The guy who does the Ig Nobel Prize sounds incredibly serious when he rings you up.
Yes.
He's the opposite of the Swedish chef.
My favorite Ig Nobel Prize is also has to do with surface, was mathematics. I think it was 2002. Ig Nobel Prize in mathematics for an Indian researcher who calculated the entire surface if you were to fold an Indian elephant open. Yeah. So what is the surface of an Indian elephant if you were to fold it open?
What do you mean?
It open. Like, no, you don't mean cut it in half and then fold.
I think fold all the surface area.
Oh, so it's very wrinkled.
Yeah. Mm. And it was really useful research because for especially vets, when they had to dose medication for elephants, they had to measure the height of the elephant. And it was very dangerous because they're moody creatures and
yes.
people get killed by them. And he could calculate it from a footprint. So he could just let an elephant walk over some mud and then measure the area of the footprint. And then he could say the entire surface area of the elephant is this. So the dosage of the medication is this, and you don't have to get near it and get killed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You know what they say about elephants with big feet? They're just big in general.
Yeah.
That's what they say. That's another saying here. You along with lob a sausage up there.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money. But nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that the first female scientist to be celebrated with a marble bust at the Royal Society was never able to visit it because women weren't allowed in the building.
Wow.
This is
kind of a nice story at the start. She got a bust.
Yes.
And then kind of tails off quite a lot at the end, that.
Yeah. This was a fact that was told to me directly by a particle accelerator physicist from Australia called Dr. Susie Sheehy. It's Shewhy, if anyone wants to look her up. She's really awesome. And she was saying it's really fascinating. This incredible scientist who was born 1780 called Mary Somerville was known as the Queen of Sciences in her time. She was such an influence that all the members of the society wanted to commemorate her with a bust in her own lifetime, and they did so, but because the rules of the society did not allow women into the building, she was never literally allowed to go and see it.
Yeah, they could have flexed the rules, but they didn't.
It's outrageous in hindsight. It's absolutely outrageous.
She could have seen it, I think, because in 1834, when she was still alive, there was a ship that was named after her called the Mary Somerville ship. And the figurehead of that ship was copied from that bust.
Ooh. And not only for the ship, a lot of the leading scientists of the Royal Society loved it so much that they asked for a casting of it for their own home so she could have gone to their houses as
Again,
well.
Again, these are just bad reasons not to let her in. I'm just livid about it.
We're not saying that this is a good conversation, but she likely would have seen it in people's homes, on the front of a ship. Yeah. So it's pretty cool. It got a lot of outing.
But her history at the Royal Society was amazing. Was she the first woman to have a paper read out, authored by her at the Royal Society? But she wasn't allowed in. Her husband had to read it out on her behalf.
Yeah.
You know, I think he had to get things out of the library from her. And she's amazing. She wrote so many extraordinary scientific works. She was an amazing mathematician. I mean, she just achieved so much in 19th century science. Mm-hmm. She pre-discovered a planet So in 1840, I love this so much. In 1842, she wrote a work saying, you know, there are some, get ready, disturbances in the movements of Uranus. All right.
no giggling in the back.
Thank you, yeah. And she basically said, it looks like there might be something else that is causing these disturbances in the movements of Uranus. And she inspired an astronomer called John Couch Adams. Lo and behold, 4 years later, Neptune is discovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right where she said it would be. It's very cool.
Is very cool. She tutored Ada Lovelace.
Really?
Yeah, so she was really sort of a pivotal figure for science back then. Yep. But she was a woman, therefore it was hard.
And what was the reason that she got to science? Because, of course, back then you had to have the time and the money. It was mostly nobles.
When she was a child, she got into Euclid, like a lot of scientists did. So Euclid is an old Greek book where he proves lots of geometry, but it's really easy to follow. You can just pick it up from the first page is like, this is what a dot is, this is what a line is, and then the final page is, this is an incredibly complicated bit of geometry. So it's really interesting for younger people to go through. So she was interested in it, and then she married her cousin, and her cousin died, but he was very rich, so she became a woman of wealth. So she could do whatever she wanted. She was quite young at this age. In actual fact, she then married another cousin of hers.
She had a type.
But rich cousins.
Yeah.
But she was wealthy, and she was interested in the sciences and so. Yeah.
And her parents originally didn't want her to learn too much. And I think for the first 7 or 8 years of her life, she wasn't taught to read, she wasn't taught anything. And eventually her parents thought, oh, we better teach her, you know, the basics of reading and accounting. Then she was getting too good. She was reading too much Euclid. And they freaked out a bit because they thought too much education had driven her sister insane.
Her sister?
Yeah. She had an older sister, right. I think. And her first husband, who you mentioned, James, who was cousin number one, Samuel Grieg, was a bit of a hindrance to her. He didn't agree with women being educated, basically. Happily, he died after 3 years, leaving her everything. So, as you say, she then got to marry cousin number two, who was a brilliant support all the way through her career, you know, and you know, hung back so she could shine, as it were.
It sounds like education was the screen time of the children back then. Just half an hour of education a day, it will drive you insane.
They used to take her candles away at night.
Really?
Yeah, that the parents would come in and going, we're taking your candles, you're reading too much.
But this is a thing you would like, James, especially. I think she got into it because there was an algebra puzzle in a friend's fashion magazine, and that's what brought her to Euclid. Mm. She thought, that seems interesting. Ah. And she begged her brother's tutor to buy her the Elements of Geometry.
And I would like this because I like fashion magazines.
That's it. You see James in public, he's never without a grazia. I just think
puzzles. I love puzzles. Yeah.
An era where fashion magazines printed algebra puzzles is a great era.
Amazing.
So the Royal Society, they didn't allow women to be members and into the building until 1945. And it was founded around 1660. There was a moment where a woman did make it in, Margaret Cavendish, who was also one of the early great female scientists of that period. She went in May of 1667, and it caused such an uproar and scandal that no one was back until 1945, basically.
She sort of got in a row with them, or some disagreement? I think she pointed out some mistakes in the experiments, probably.
Yeah.
Like, she was really interested in science.
Yeah. She was very extravagant for her age. She wore men's clothes, which was seen very strange at the time. John Evelyn, who was there, said, her headgear was so pretty, I never saw anything so witty, though I was half afeard. God bless us. When I did see her, she looked like a cavalier, but that she had no beard. Samuel Pepys, who was there, said, the Duchess had been good, comely woman, but her dress is so antic and her deportment so unordinary that I do not like her at all.
Oof.
So I think she was just a bit like, she wasn't what you would expect to be in the Royal Society at the time.
Yeah.
And that was it. But there was actually someone who was a fellow before 1945, a woman, and that was Queen Victoria, she was an honorary royal fellow because it's the Royal Society and she was royalty.
Right. She was it.
So she was allowed to be a member, but like it was a member by name, really.
She didn't go in.
So the idea of women not being part of these science institutions, not just the UK, like this was global. There's one great example, which is that in France in 1911, the Académie rejected Marie Curie to be a member of it. Mm. 1911 is the year that she won her second Nobel Prize in sciences.
If you get three, we'll let you in. But two, I think you're still an amateur if you only have two Nobel Prizes.
It's so weird that you have these people who are supposed to be very logical doing experiments, but still, the having a woman there who has won two Nobel Prizes still going, well, no, I don't think it's appropriate for you to enter here. How do you get your head? Well, humans are very creative in rationalizing these things, of course. Yeah.
There was to come back to the UK, the Royal Society, their earliest published report by a woman in their journal was attributed to Governor Belcher's lady. That's who's written this.
Right, yeah.
And there was Hertha Ayrton. She was a brilliant scientist, and she improved electric lighting dramatically, I think, in the early 20th century. And a group of scholars proposed, look, we really should let in a woman into the society. And then they said, oh, sorry, you're married. Sorry, if you've been single, different matter. And Hertha Ayrton, she was told at the age of 52, I'm sorry, you're just too old to contribute to the Royal Society, while the Society's president at the time was in his 80s.
Right.
It was, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, massive double standards, but yeah.
Maria Mitchell's another interesting one. So she was an astronomy person in the 19th century, and she was friends with Mary Somerville. She came over to Europe to meet her. She couldn't get into the Royal Society. They wouldn't let her in there. But when she met George Airy, FRS, the British Astronomer Royal, he said to her, in England, there is no astronomical public and we do not need to make science popular.
Wow. And
so she went on round Europe and visited lots of people. And then she went to the Vatican, where they had an amazing astronomy place. And she wanted to go and look at their telescopes. And she was told that because she was a woman, she wasn't allowed there after dark. So she could go and look at the telescopes during the daytime.
Oh, no.
But as soon as it went dark, women were not allowed in.
Wow.
Isn't Jesus. That amazing?
Oh, God. We've mentioned that there was the Mary Somerville ship.
Mm.
And that was... Again, in her lifetime, that ship was out there, so she would have seen the bus.
It sank with all hands aboard in her lifetime.
Yes.
Did about 20 years and then...
Yeah, exactly. There's only one other fact, as far as I can tell, that also had a ship named after it that we've done on today's show. A little quiz question.
We've done cranes.
HMS Silica Gel.
It's incredible to see it plow its way across the seabed.
Always in dry dock.
Is the correct answer.
No.
There was a ship that was named after Silica, and it too also sank. So it's now at the bottom of the ocean somewhere.
So slowly getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
I wonder how much higher the ocean would be if that didn't happen.
That's great. She's on the Scottish tenor now, Mary Somerville, which is nice.
Oh, that's nice.
Because she grew up in Scotland as of 2017. And if you look at it under UV light, there's a little Easter egg hidden in there. It's a lunar diagram, which is from one of her books called The Mechanism of the Heavens.
Cool.
So that's very cool. She was also, the other thing she did, she was a real science communicator. Like,
yeah. Oh, really?
She did do brilliant mathematical work and science in herself, but she also wrote these incredible books which explained and drew together science to lots of people. And there's this report, you see it in lots of places, said that she was called the first person ever called a scientist, because there was a review of one of her books by William Whewell, who coined the word scientist in review. He didn't actually call her a scientist. He just said, it's crazy that we have chemists and biologists and we have blahists and everything, but where's the word? Why don't we call them a scientist? And scientists at the time hated the idea of the word scientist, because they were getting very snotty about the idea of professional scientists coming and ruining a traditionally amateur's game for rich blokes.
Well, as a physicist, you don't want to be in the same room with a chemist, of course. There shouldn't be one word or an engineer.
Yeah.
Can I tell you a thing about her husband, her second husband?
Yes.
So I've got here, you can see, this is Reflections by Mary Somerville.
Yeah.
This is a first edition of her memoir.
Wow.
Which was printed a couple of years after she died. Look, there's the bust.
Yes.
You can see the Royal Society bust.
Yes.
And it begins with a little intro from her daughter saying, this is genuinely how it begins, right? The life of a woman entirely devoted to her family duties and to scientific pursuits affords little scope for a biography. Okay, why have I just bought this? There are in it neither stirring events nor brilliant deeds. Okay. and my mother was strongly averse to gossip and to revelations of private life or intimate correspondence, so nothing of the kind will be found in the following pages. Why have I bought this book?
It's the silicon gel of literature is what it is.
And she's underselling it, right? Because in the first two pages, there's a shipwreck and there's two sea battles and the American Revolution.
Wow. Which
her father was involved in all of that.
Oh, wow.
And then get this about, so her second husband, also her cousin, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to read this. My mother was dangerously ill and when Mary herself was born. But my aunt was about to wean her second daughter, Janet. So my aunt nursed me till a wet nurse could be found. So I was born in the house of my future husband and nursed by his mother.
They'd both been suckled.
Weren't
at the same...
about the same age, I bet.
They were about the same age.
One on each teat.
It might have been.
No wonder the daughter's like, nothing to read here. Just maybe put it down. Just put it down.
Five pages in, you're getting some double suckling stories.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we're all online. I'm on Instagram on @Schreiberland. James?
This morning, Levin added me on LinkedIn.
I did.
So why not add me on LinkedIn as well?
I got a request as well.
Yeah, I can tell you why, because I'm touring with this AI show and it's so popular amongst companies that then I have to go to LinkedIn to promote this stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's the boomer TikTok and that's where I'm at.
Okay. Is there anywhere else to find you online, Levin?
Yes, on my website, levinschere.com, but because you cannot spell this, I've also registered leavingshire.com.
Andy.
I'm on Instagram at AndrewHunterM.
Yep, and you can get to us as a group online as well. But if you want to send us anything, podcast@qi.com, that is our email address. All the emails go to Andy. He reads them through, he collects the best of them, and he brings it to our bonus episode, which is the mailbag episode called Drop Us a Line. We do it every 2 weeks. We absolutely love it. So if you've got a great story about something you've heard us say, send it there. Or if you have a great fact, also send it there, because Andy collects those and we bring it to Little Fish, which is our new Monday show. Hopefully you've heard it by now, where instead of our facts, we do all of your facts. So if you want to listen to Jewel, go to patreon.com/nosuchthingasafish. You can join up there. We got lots of fun tiers. If you want to just listen to our other shows or you want to check out anything else about us, want to go to nosuchthingasafish.com. All of our previous episodes are up there. And if you want to see an incredible night of science, go to Levin Skier's AI tour, which is happening in the next couple of months. Levin, when do you start?
It's March. I start, I think, the 10th of March. I will start in Leeds, and then I go all over the country. It's not in a geographical, logical order, so I'm going to drive up and down all the time.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Great.
So it's the last 3 weeks of March, and I'll end in London on March 28th.
That's right, Leicester Square Theatre.
That's
very
it.
Exciting. Yeah. All right, well, that is it for us. Thank you as well to our production team, Liang Lee, Ethan Ruparelia, and all of the other Fishbusters who are working behind the scenes. And we're going to be back again next week with another episode. We'll see you then. Goodbye.